I call Senate Resources Committee to order. Today is Monday, February 19th, 2018. Let the record reflect that the time is 3:30 p.m. Committee members with us today, Senator Meyer, Senator Stedman, Senator Coghill, Senator Bishop, and Senator Wilikowski, as well as myself, Senator Giesel. I expect Senator von Imhoff along shortly. So today, by the way, thank you to Benjamin and Ann for helping us out, and welcome Senator von Imhoff. We were just starting. Today the committee has two items on the agenda. So first we're going to take up the confirmation hearing for two of the governor's appointees. Ms. Wilson is not available today. She was formerly on the agenda, but something came up and she couldn't join us. So we'll just have two. And then we'll take up the first hearing of Senate Bill 164 from the Department of Environmental Conservation. So we'll start out with governor's appointees. The first one is for, turning to the page, the State Assessment Review Board. And that will be Mr. Bradley Pickett. So what we will do is have each of the appointees make a statement. We'll take some questions from committee members for the appointees. And then after we've heard from both of them, we'll do public testimony on both appointees together. And then we can ask any other questions after that. There's no vote, just for clarification for the public who might be listening, there's no vote on the appointees today. We are reviewing their qualifications and just getting that on the record, so we are not voting in any way. So with that, Mr. Bradley Pickett is on the line. He's calling in from the MATSU LIO. Mr. Pickett, welcome. Before you speak, I think committee members may have the fact sheet about the State Assessment Review Board in their packets. This is a five-member board that must be knowledgeable about the assessment procedures for pipeline transportation of gas or unrefined oil. So they meet once a year, it looks like, usually in mid-May, for a 2 to 3 day meeting, and the compensation is standard travel and per diem. So just some basic information about that particular review board. So with that, Mr. Pickett, welcome to the committee. If you would introduce yourself for the record, and then just tell us about yourself and why you're interested in the State Assessment Review Board.
Madam Chair, thank you. This is Brad Pickett. Currently, I'm the assessor for the MATSU Borough. I've been in appraisal for 16 years working for the MATSU Borough. Eight of those years, I served as the commercial appraiser. So I do have the background to serve on the State Assessment Review Board with the cost approach, and I am familiar with the type of applications that we will be reviewing. It's an honor to be appointed to this board. The other folks that are on it that I've met so far are very distinguished in the community, and I look forward to having the opportunity to work with them and to gain knowledge in my time that I'll be serving on this board.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Pickett. Questions for Mr. Pickett? Committee members. Yes, Senator Coghill.
First of all, thank you for being willing to step up and do this, Brad. Have you had a chance to attend any of the meetings up to this point?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill. Yes, last year I did attend two meetings and sat through them. I wasn't able to participate, but it did give me an idea of what to expect, and I got a little bit excited by sitting through them. They're very well run, very professional, and again, I think it'll be an honor to serve on this committee.
Yes, Senator Coghill.
I might follow up, and thank you for doing that. I think that's an important part. So from your perspective, going from where you're at the municipal level and going into this, what do you see as the jump of things that you need to know, first of all, that you might bring to the table, but secondly, that are going to be new to you?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, areas that I can bring to the table, I have a strong background in commercial appraisal, doing the cost approach. Areas that I'm going to have to learn are some of the terminology for the oil and gas pipeline systems. I did look at quite a bit of the information and began reviewing that last year, but again, the terminology is something that I'm not familiar with, but I think in time it'll be a good fit for me.
Follow-up, Senator Coghill?
Madam Chair, and thank you. Probably between the people who are area distributors and big pipelines, you're going to find a whole legal trail. Have you had a chance to look at some of the case law that has come around the regulation or the law that has put in place, or is that something that the law, the legal experts in that board present?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, there is legal expertise on the board. They did give me information to review, and so I have had the opportunity to review some of the legal standings that the previous cases were based on, and I think it is good that there is legal experts on this board because it is very technical.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Other questions for Mr. Pickett? All right, seeing none. Mr. Pickett, thank you for joining us. If you would stay on the line in case, you know, we have questions later on, we're going to interview Mr. Paul Lazansky next. Mr. Lazansky is applying for or has been appointed to the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. Again, members of the committee have the information sheet in front of them. This is a 5-member board. The person has some requirements they have to meet, a good standing with the Alaska Bar Association, or have a degree with a major in engineering, finance, economics, accounting, business administration, or public administration, and then actual experience for a period of 5 years in the practice of law or in the field of engineering, finance, economics, accounting, business administration, or public administration. So there's definitely requirements here. The compensation is a range 27 pay as an exempt employee, and the hearings are continuous throughout the year. So that is a substantial job. It sounds pretty full-time. Mr. Lazansky, welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your experience that would qualify you for this position and why you're seeking it. Welcome.
Madam Chair, Diesel, and members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Paul F. Lasanke. I want to thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today as I begin the process of seeking the legislature's confirmation of my appointment. I also want to thank Governor Walker for appointing me to complete the term of my former colleague, and I believe a former colleague of some of you as well, Commissioner and former State Representative Norman Roper. As you, I believe, are aware from the submission to the committee, this is a truncated appointment. It is due to expire March 1st, 2019, roughly a year from, or a little bit more than a year from today. I certainly intend to keep my remarks brief, partly in order to preserve as much as your available time for committee members to ask me questions or to bring matters to my attention that you may feel I need to keep an eye on as I serve as a commissioner. But additionally, because I have relatively recently completed a full term as a commissioner on the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, that term was from 2009 until the end of February 2015. As you might imagine, in doing so, I have left a substantial and a readily available record concerning the regulatory matters that I dealt with and also the nature of my participation in them. I think it's only reasonable to take the position that words don't speak as loudly as deeds, and therefore any general statements I can make this afternoon, I would assume, and going forward would presume, will be secondary to any commentary that might arise from my six-year tour that was so recently done. Before I forget, Madam Chair Easel asked me to address the qualifications, and I'm a bit of a twofer. I'm one of the lawyers that has also got a degree in economics, and we have had several of those at the commission during my period of service, and I think it is helpful, those of us in the economics area have sometimes a little more exposure to numbers than some of the lawyers that don't come up through that tribulation. And I think in dealing with rate cases and things like that, some exposure to statistics and mathematical analysis comes in handy. I do want to state that as far as my personal background, that I'm an Alaskan by choice rather than by birth. I came to Alaska arriving in Kodiak in 1982 in my late 20s. Took me a while to figure out that I needed to get up to Alaska. I moved to Anchorage in 1984. Except for a period from 2004 to 2008 when I moved to Juneau so that I could be a division director in the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, I have continued to live in Anchorage. Since my retirement, I have continued living in Anchorage for the bulk of my time. And I checked before I came over today, and I think the longest I was out of state, although I have done some traveling, is about 26 days in one shot. So I want to assure the committee that while I did retire, I maintained serious residence within the state of Alaska. When it comes to the position of a commissioner on the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, I would agree with any commissioner that it is an honor. It's a privilege to serve the people of the state of Alaska in that position, and it's also a very great responsibility. I approach it with that in mind. I attempt to be diligent in my preparation so that I can ensure that I'm fully prepared to responsibly consider the matters that have come before us. I try to treat everyone coming before the commission with respect, and I attempt to fairly resolve disputes to the best of my ability. Whether or not I always do that, I guess time will tell, but I certainly try. Finally, if I may, when we do resolve disputes or when we adopt regulations, I try to apply some basic broad guidelines. Most important is that I believe that whatever we're asked to do, that we try to make sure that our actions are consistent with the intent of the underlying statutory provisions that we're asked to construe and to guide us. And similarly, when we're asked to make policy pronouncements, my first question and my last question is always whether we are operating within the parameters of the statutory provisions that we have been appointed to apply. And if that makes a little extra work for you all, I apologize. But it is not unknown for me to say that if I'm not convinced that what we're being asked to do falls within our statutory authority, no matter how good the idea, my recommendation is that the legislature be consulted and the law be appropriately amended. So with that, I will wrap up what I hope was relatively brief comments, and I look forward to answering any questions you may have orally, or if I'm not able to do so, I'm certainly willing to follow up in writing and present that to the committee as we move forward.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lozenki. Questions for Mr. Lozenki? Yes, Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. Do you anticipate that the Regulatory Commission will be looking at the Chugiak MLP purchase? And are you familiar with that and getting yourself familiar with that?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, the short answer to your question is yes. I fully expect that the Regulatory Commission will be asked to examine any proposed sale of municipal light and power to Chugach Electric Association. At this point, the process hasn't really evolved yet, as you know, and so I can't say that I've really done much to in the way of preparation on that question.
Follow-up, Senator Von Imhoff? Mr. Any other questions for Mr. Luzzenchi?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Coghill.
First of all, after having gone through one round, the fact that you're willing to step up, thank you. Thank you very much. But it is also something that you could instruct us on. You know, you deal with several different worlds within the Regulatory Commission, and as a commission, there's always been a pressure on how do we deal in depth with some of the issues that are different, say, for example, on hydrocarbons versus electrons. How do you see us doing now that you've sat on that seat for a while?
Senator Coghill, through the chair, that's a very interesting question. You cut to the core of a lot of the primary challenges that we face on a policy basis. As you know, a lot of what the commission is asked to do is to fill in the, I don't want to say spaces, but to fill in some of the particulars of broader policy guidelines. And I can't say that it's really been easy. There, as you are well aware, there's a push and pull. There's for every good idea, there's somebody that thinks it's a bad idea. But we do our best to try and parse out what works for Alaska. And I say that advisedly because I think that Alaska, as much as we like to think we're unique, and we may not be in certain ways, when it comes to energy and regulating utilities, we really are somewhat unique. I refer to it as kind of an energy archipelago. We're not literally all on islands, but we're islanded by various, you know, mountain ranges and the sea and rivers. And trying to adopt or adapt what they're doing in the lower 48 doesn't always work smoothly here in Alaska. So all I can promise you, Senator Coghill, is that I'll take a hard look, and I'll always try and do what seems to me to make sense for Alaska, regardless of how it plays at the annual convention.
Follow-up, Senator Coghill?
First of all, thank you. And I know every topic is probably dense and complicated. Filtering up to the legislature quite often is the question on should we separate out some of those units? Should we take, like, the telecom issue, separate it out from the municipal or the electron world or the gas world? They're so vastly different, and the bodies of law just seem to get bigger and bigger. The question keeps rising up to our level on have we formulated it right? I guess probably for the question I'd have for you is the expertise and the workload within the staff as a commissioner, have you found that they're still able to handle those complexities? Do we have to have subject experts housed in each section? How does that work from your perspective?
Senator Coghill, through the chair, since I've only been back at the commission for roughly 2 weeks, I started on February 1st. It was kind of an abrupt change from retirement. I can't give you up-to-the-minute impression. I will say, based on my prior experience, that I felt that our staff was able to deal with the subject matters that were confronting us. I do know that we have somewhat fewer staff as I speak today than we did 3 years ago. I would certainly be willing to assure you that I will take a hard look and ask the chairman for his opinion. But as of the time I left in 2015, I felt that we did have adequate staff to address all of the subject matter issues that you have given us to consider.
And one last question,
Senator Coghill.
Thank you very much. And I know I asked a lot there that you'll get the chance to ponder probably the next few years. The other thing is, this is the knucklehead question. This is a public seat. What was the seat that you held prior?
Actually, through the chair, Senator Cotto, I think that they're all denominated public now.
Okay. All right.
I'm aware that a number of years ago there was a distinction between some of the so-called professional seats and the public seats. I believe now that in boards and commissions, they're all referred to as public because that's just the way it's listed. They're no longer singular to the law or economics or engineering the way they once were.
Thank you. I stand corrected and instructed. Thank you very much.
Further questions? Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you. Hi, Paul. So a big issue for South Central has been Cook Inlet gas prices over the years, and I know that's an issue that you've tackled in previous years, but are you comfortable with where we're at in Cook Inlet in terms of one corporation holding a predominant amount of the gas? Do you feel there's sufficient competition there so that the utilities can get fair gas prices?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, it is nice to see you as well. I think, as you are pretty well aware, that there is not a lot of leverage to drive competition in the gas market in Cook Inlet. What I'm trying to say in a very inarticulate way is there really isn't any control over who acquires what assets. The natural gas industry was deregulated by the federal government and has continued that way subsequently. The short answer to your question is I wish there was more competition. I will do whatever I can do in approving gas contracts that are negotiated by the various utilities to give them the flexibility to inject whatever competition they're able to do through negotiated procurements. I'm not sure there's a lot more that can be done at this point.
Follow-up, Senator Wilikowski?
No.
Great. Any other questions for Mr. Lozanski? Yes. Senator Bishop.
Just a comment. Paul, you failed at retirement twice, and the state thanks you for it, and I especially thank you for it.
Very good.
Through the chair, I don't know that that calls for a response, but Senator Bishop, it's certainly nice to see you, and I admit that I have failed the requirement of retirement twice. And I want to assure you that I'm coming into this one by telling everybody that my intention is to serve out the short remainder of Commissioner Roebuck's term and then ride off into the sunset.
Yes, Senator Bishop.
Follow-up. That was a loaded question, ma'am. Paul bailed me out at the department, and he stepped up to the plate. He was going to retire a year early, and he come out and helped us again for another year. And it appears that everything he said about being in Alaska by choice is true, because he's stepping up to the plate again. So, thanks, Paul.
Thanks for those comments, Senator Bishop. I certainly am thankful. I mean, here is Mr. Lozanski, very familiar with how the Regulatory Commission works, and willing to step in to an open seat very abruptly, so that's great. So with that, we will open public comment. So at this time, we will take public comment on these two appointees. So those wishing to speak should identify themselves and their affiliation and then speak to the appointment, your knowledge, your acquaintanceship with Mr. Lozanski or Mr. Pickett and their qualifications and whether you support them for appointment. So let's see, the first person on the list is Tom Boutin, calling in from Juneau in the off-net. Mr. Boutin.
Yes, hi. Thanks very much. Tom Boutin here. I moved to Alaska in 1973, and my wife and I moved to Juneau from Haines in 1982. And thanks for the hearing again. I'm testifying today as a member of the Alaska chapter of the Association of Mature American Citizens. I sure don't have any negative things or anything to say except thanks to these people who are stepping up to offer to serve on these boards, but I sure urge all senators to withhold action on any Walker administration appointees until Governor Walker follows and completes the standard process for filling the Senate District E vacancy. If this is a hockey game in the second session of the legislature here, you'd already be in the second period, and one Senate district has no senator, thanks to the administration so far mishandling the process. And so, anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you for your comments. I will ask that we constrain our discussion to the two appointees at hand. Mr. Mike Coons is also on the line. Mr. Coons.
Yes, ma'am. Senator Giesel, this is Mike Coons. I'm from Palmer, and I'm speaking for myself. And I am the president of Alaska's Chapter for Association of Mature American Citizens, AMAC. We have a statewide membership of 4,500, and our Alaska chapter is 200 and growing. Governor Walker, per Alaska Constitution, has put forward Mr. Pickett, Ms. Wilson, and Mr. Lizansky for boards and commissions. That is his duty as governor. The people of District E, following Alaska Republican rules, have investigated and vetted many people to fill the vacant seat for Senate District E, then submitted.
Mr. Coons, you either are supporting or not Mr. Pickett or Mr. Lizansky, and I'm not sure which you were, but thanks very much for your comments. Any other people online wishing to make comment about these two appointees? Seeing none, is there anyone else in the room wishing to comment on the two appointees? All right, seeing none, we'll close public testimony. So with that, I will read the appointee committee report as the report is being passed around for signatures. In accordance with AS39.05.080, the Resources Committee reviewed the following and recommends the appointments be forwarded to the joint session for consideration. Assessment Review Board, Bradley Pickett Palmer, appointed 2/26/17. Term expires, it doesn't have an expiration on it. Regulatory Commission of Alaska, Paul Lizansky from Anchorage, appointed 1/31/2018, term expires 3/1/2019. This does not reflect an intent by any of the members to vote for or against the confirmation of the individuals during any future sessions. So we will sign this report, send it on to the Senate Secretary. So that will end this portion of the meeting. We'll take a brief at ease while we finish signing the committee report. We're back on the record. We are now taking up our second item. This is Senate Bill 164. This was brought to us by the administration, and it's being managed by the Department of Environmental Conservation. So we have Alita Buss at the table. She's going to manipulate the slides for us. But those speaking to us online will be Arthur Keyes. He's the director of the Division of Agriculture in DNR. Christina Carpenter, she's the director of the Division of Public Health in DEC, and Robert Gerlach, Department of Environmental Conservation, the state veterinarian. So, welcome everyone. If you would, as you speak, identify yourself for the record, especially as you change speakers, and Alita's here to change slides for you. So I'll let you begin, whoever was going to begin.
Good afternoon, this is Christina Carpenter with the Division of Environmental Health. I am the division director, and with me I have Dr. Robert Gerlach. Today we're here to speak to the committee members about Senate Bill 164, which would make certain records held by DEC NDNR confidential. Alita, could you proceed or advance the slides? Okay. Okay, wonderful. Sorry, we're trying to watch on the TV and there's a delay, so.
Alita is switching the slides quite promptly for you, so.
Thank you. All right. So, Senate Bill 164 would amend 0305 to add a new section that would make certain animal health and crop records held by the Department of Environmental Conservation and Department of Natural Resources confidential. This has been a coordinated effort across both departments, but the request is really coming from the industry. We've had agricultural producers contact us repeatedly over the last 10 years or so requesting a change to our statutes that would provide Alaskan agricultural producers with similar confidentiality that is already afforded to many other commercial industries in Alaska. For example, Fish and Game has a statute that specifically makes commercial fishery records held by Fish and Game confidential. So we took that as an example and worked with our attorneys to develop this. Alita, can you advance the slide? So as I mentioned in the Senate Senate committee last week, you heard me call this the HIPAA for hogs and hay. That's how we fondly refer to it in our office, and it's true. We believe that it would allow us to engage with Alaskan producers more early in the event of a suspected disease outbreak or a morbidity or a mortality circumstance, because they would want to engage with us to identify a threat early on and try to limit any sort of disease outbreak so that it wouldn't spread to neighboring facilities or be a public health risk. I'm going to now turn it over to Dr. Robert Gerlach. He's going to talk more about the Office of the State Veterinarian and some of the duties that they perform and the records that he is in receipt of.
Well, before you do, Ms. Carpenter, so justify why having these records confidential protects the public. Because fundamentally, that is the role of these kinds of animal testing and crop testing procedures.
For the record, this is Christina Carpenter. And I can give you, let me give you an example. In the event that there was a suspected zoonotic disease outbreak on a farm, we would hope, but say that it wasn't a reportable disease, we would hope that producers and their private veterinarians would engage with us very early at the suspected outbreak before it grew and got off-premise and maybe started impacting some of their neighbors or the other members of the public. So the department believes that by engaging with farmers early, because they're no longer reluctant to submit their animals or crops to voluntary testing, it would encourage better animal and public health, because we'd be able to respond faster in the event of a suspected public health, I apologize, in the event of a disease outbreak. And Dr. Kerlak has some examples during his overview, and he's a veterinarian, so he might be able to provide you with more real-life examples.
All right. Dr. Gerlach.
Yes, this is Bob Gerlach. I'm the state veterinarian and work in the Department of Environmental Conservation. This slide that's up there now shows you some of the responsibilities of our office, and it's for the prevention of prevention and control and eradication of animal diseases, including diseases that would affect livestock and pets, as well as diseases that livestock and pets may carry that may be transmitted to people, so protection of public health, as well as food safety. And to do these jobs, we are required or will need to go ahead and collect quite a bit of data and information from animal owners, where they obtained their animal, where the animals are located, what disease test records they may have, what animals are being moved or processed to send to other farms or locations. So if there is an outbreak, we would have access to that information to be able to go ahead and effectively do our job. And every year we're collecting more and more data from people because of animal disease certification programs and other marketing programs that are there that require us to go ahead and collect this data. On the next slide, you can see some of the number of records that we're collecting. So we're collecting import regulation or import data, permits, as well as health records from animals coming into the state, disease surveillance records that we keep to ensure that our both state partners as well as international partners that the state is free of diseases such as tuberculosis or brucellosis or pseudorabies. And a lot of these programs are required for access to certain markets. Some of them are required for access for importation of animals to the state. Some of them are just for proof of animal health, and others are validation programs, and that they're used then for farmers to not just gain access to markets, but to be able to promote and declare the quality of their product as a marketing tool. And as we collect this data, what we'd like to do would be to go ahead and provide and share this data with our partners that would be involved with mitigating or controlling these disease spreads and keeping animals healthy and food safe, but not necessarily release confidential business data or proprietary data or personal data that may be leave the producer vulnerable, so that it would essentially allow us to collect more data and have more people participate in these programs and do our job more efficiently, and then protect those proprietary information from these participants.
Dr. Gerlach? Dr. Gerlach? Dr. Gerlach?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, if you could pause for a moment. I'm back on slide 4, okay, and that was the one that says Office of the State Veterinarian, and I'm going to call out the slides that we're on for the public who might be listening. But I'm back on this slide because the header says Office of the State Veterinarian, and yet you are not the only veterinarian in state government. True?
Yes, through the chair, I am not the only veterinarian working for the state. There are several veterinarians that work for the state, but I am the only veterinarian in statute as classified as the state veterinarian with the statutory authority for regulating animal health, collecting this data, and then responsible for the control and mitigation to prevent the spread of these diseases.
Could you clarify? So my understanding is the Department of Health and Social Services has a veterinarian, at least one, perhaps two. And the Department of Natural Resources has a wildlife veterinarian, perhaps two. So what exactly is your lane, and what is your interaction with the other state veterinarians?
Yes, ma'am. My interaction with those other veterinarians is on a continual basis in regard to disease issues that would be important to their particular function. So Dr. Louisa Castrodale over in public health is involved with food safety and zoonotic disease issues, as well as the epidemiology of other human diseases. When it comes down to our identifying or determining an outbreak or a contaminated product, then we contact Dr. Castrodale and then work within the authorities each of our divisions have or departments have to go ahead and mitigate this response, where my responsibility is limited to the control of the animals. Dr. Castrodale would work with public health officials to, if this disease, say if it was a zoonotic disease that got spread to people, then use effective controls to prevent the further spread of the disease among among human beings in the state. In regard to the function of Dr. Kimberly Beckman at Fish and Game, and you're right, they are looking to hire a second veterinarian for that. The same thing would apply. If we find a disease or an outbreak in domestic animals, whether they're livestock or pets, then we coordinate with Dr. Beckman and Fish and Game in the control and of this to go ahead and prevent that spread into our wildlife resources. And this does then protect not just the wildlife, but also protects the if it could possibly be a disease that could impact then the food safety of the meat or animals that are harvested for subsistence or recreational or commercial use.
Thank you for that overview. Yes, thanks for correcting me. I had said DNR, and it's actually ADF&G that has the other veterinarian. Great, thank you. So then on page 5, under the dairy program, how many staff are on that in the dairy program? This is on slide 5, the middle of the page. And how many dairy farms are there in the state?
Yes, Senator Giesel. There is one dairy farm currently in production of grade A milk in the state, and there is a second dairy that is gearing up to go ahead and get back into production. We have a third dairy that's looking at increasing or also participating in the grade A milk production of pasteurized milk in the state for commercial sale. We are working with those two dairies to get them up to speed to go ahead and meet the requirements, which are facility requirements for the care and the feeding of the animals on the farm, as well as sanitation and disinfection on those farms, and then the transport of the milk and then processing of that milk at a pasteurization plant to make sure that the product at the end meets the requirements for grade A milk that could be sold within the state.
Thank you. So is there one staff person in the dairy section there, or is it just you?
Senator Diesel, I apologize for missing that part of your question. There are two other people that work on the dairy program, Dr. Sarah Colburn, who's the assistant state veterinarian, and then we have a sanitarian, a dairy sanitarian. The dairy sanitarian does the farm inspections and also tests the equipment, and Dr. Colburn does many of the inspections and certification inspections as well, and then acts as our communication with the FDA to assure that the state program is meeting the federal requirements for production of grade A milk.
All right, thank you. And I assume that the dairies, well, there's one that's in production, must pay fees that cover this program?
there are there is a fee to a permit fee to initially get into and become a part of the program, but the other the equipment test, the sanitation, and the farm inspection are not charged for, and the testing of the raw milk as well as the processed products that is done at the Environmental Health Laboratory here in Anchorage, there are no fees for that.
Thank you. Any other questions on up to slide 5 from committee members? All right, seeing none, we can go on to slide 6. Thank you, Dr. Gerlach.
Oh, you're very welcome, ma'am. So slide 6 is just a slide to show the throughout the last 4 fiscal years the increased number of animals that are being imported into the state and the increase in the number of import permits. And this is just an illustration to demonstrate the more information that we're collecting from a larger number or larger group of people throughout the state. And as that data collection grows, if that information is that can be kept confidential, then protects those individuals from release of their personal data or proprietary business data. We also have an increased number of farms, agricultural farms now, that we're collecting data on as part of our produce food safety program that we're taking primacy for the FDA Food Safety Modernization Act. Requires farms to go ahead and disclose financial information as well as product information and inspection information on their farms, which is business and proprietary data that we would like to go ahead and protect. On the next slide is a demonstration or listing of some of the disease outbreaks we've had in the state of Alaska. And the point of this slide is to show that we collect quite a bit of surveillance data so that we can maintain we have a large list of reportable diseases that we work with producers and veterinarians that are required to report to us and laboratories as well to report to the office. This data is used to go ahead and as well as with our investigation of morbidity or mortality events in both wild and domestic animals across the state to get an idea of disease issues there and try to go ahead and maintain and animal health and prevent the spread of these diseases. The number of reports that we get each year for these type of disease outbreaks, it does increase as well. And as you see, with more people that we're collecting data from, we want to make sure that they will be comfortable in sharing that data with us so that we can do our job more efficiently to protect the animal health resources in the state. And then as well as provide a better support for agricultural and animal industries in the state so that they can grow and increase their production without fear of outbreaks and disease risk to the products that they are producing. So what we want to do with this bill is to go ahead and collect data, be able to maintain and do our job, but also protect the personal data, the business data, and proprietary data that can be oftentimes misused that would put that person or that producer in a vulnerable state. And I will go ahead and let Christina continue with the presentation.
Well, before you go, Dr. Gerlach, so keeping this information confidential, well, what if there is an outbreak? Does then the information get disclosed?
That's correct, Senator Giesel. The information would be shared with our partners, and as I mentioned, if it was a zoonotic disease or a foodborne disease, we would be sharing that information to contain that threat with Department of Health and Social Services. the Food Safety Sanitation Division in Environmental Health, the CDC, and the FDA. If we had an outbreak associated with a disease that might impact the health of our livestock or domestic pets as well as wildlife, we would be sharing that data with the Division of Natural Resources, with the Department of Fish and Game, as well as with the USDA, to go ahead and be able to use the resources that they have in their departments to help us do a better job to go ahead and contain those diseases, prevent the spread, and protect animal health.
Thank you. Senator Meyer has a question as well, Dr. Gerlach.
Thank you, Dr. Gerlach. Dr. Gerlach, on slide 6, where you talk about animal imports, and I think I recall this question coming up in State Affairs, but what prevents somebody from importing animals and selling them as Alaska-grown?
Yes, Senator Meyer, through the chair, as long as animals meet the both the federal and the state requirements for importation into the state, then we allow them into the state, and they can be used by the importer for whatever purpose they intend them for. If it's whether it's personal consumption, if it's for commercial sale, then the labeling and marketing of that product is regulated by other entities. And so, if the owner is going to make a claim that is that it meets the standards for Alaska grown, then the Division of Agriculture is responsible for validation of that program, and then they would be approaching that producer to go ahead and get information to be assured that the product that they're selling does meet the requirements of that Alaska-grown program.
Okay, thank you.
So, Senator Dr. Gerlach, this is Senator Giesel again. So you must regulate the animals as they're imported then. So you would be sharing that information with the Division of Ag that this was an imported animal?
Not necessarily, Senator Giesel. What we would be doing is if the we maintain the import information so that we can do our job with tracking animals that come into the state and where they're located in the state, and to go ahead and assure their health and that they're not threatening the health of other animals, whether domestic or wildlife in the state. But we don't share that data, necessarily specific data, with other entities. We do, just like on slide 6, give reports to the Farm Bureau and producers, as well as the Alaska Veterinary Medical Association and other, and as well as the USDA, to go ahead and inform them of the animals that are being imported and the work that we're doing.
Thank you. Senator Bishop, you had a question.
Madam Chair, thank you. Dr. Gerlach, the most of these imports, do they come via truck from Canada over the Alaska Highway, or are they coming, air freight, or how are they coming? And what's the impound timeline?
Yes, Senator Bishop, through the chair, that's a great question. In the past, we had seen most animals coming up through the land port at Alcan or down into Haines, and that's recently changed with the animal transport restrictions in Canada for sheep and goats. Some concerns that they have, now many of the sheep and goat producers are shipping their animals up by airline because they're of the restrictions of moving them through Canada. We have been working with the Canadians as well as the USDA to resolve those issues to provide better service for the producers in the state to bring up new animals for increasing their genetic stock and broadening the or increasing the efficiency of their production. We also have some, probably a minority of animals that are moved up through the ferry system.
Follow-up, Senator Bishop?
Yes, one follow-up. The second part of that question was, how do you impound them when they get here for a period of time?
Senator Bishop, through the chair, no, we do not impound them. We don't have any authority we don't have a person at the ports that would have the authority to go ahead and impound those animals. So when they come in, our state import regulations are set so that we can be assured that they're healthy and safe when they come through the border and to the final destination. And one of the reasons we want to go ahead and keep this information and provide this confidentiality to the producers, so that if they do have those animals come in and there is a problem, that they will report to us and let us know that we can go ahead and follow up. In some animals that are imported from Canada directly, then those animals are under impound to the site or the premise of destination until they can be inspected by the USDA veterinarian. And oftentimes our office does send a representative with the USDA veterinarian to go ahead and inspect those imports.
Thank you. Any other questions for Dr. Gerlach? All right. So let's see. Are we moving on then to page 8, slide 8?
For the record, this is Christina Carpenter. Yes, we are on slide 8. And this is a brief sectional analysis. Section 1 would make certain records that we've identified today held by DEC and DNR confidential if they meet certain criteria. And it would also allow the departments to disclose that information if there is a threat to the health or safety of an animal, crop, or the public. Section 2 allows the departments to adopt regulations to implement the Act. At this time, DEC does not foresee any need to adopt regulations. And Section 3 would provide for an immediate effective date. So moving on to slide 9, just to give a recap of the benefits that we foresee with the passage of this legislation. We believe that there would be better animal husbandry and crop management, and we hope that the results would be a growth in the Alaska agriculture industry, and that if there was a suspected sickness or disease outbreak, that we would have those producers engaging with us early so that we could keep any outbreak small and take action on it so that the public health risk was minimal. So with that, we're available for any additional questions that the committee may have.
Senator Coghill.
Thank you. Thank you for your presentation. So two questions. One of them is, once you get this bill and it's an immediate effective date, what are the things that you have to do immediately? Because it's the confidentiality thing that is probably going to, you know, it is just drops right now. Does it impact business practices now? Is it a welcome relief, or is it a yank in the system?
Senator Coghill, through the chair, this is Dr. Gerlach. No, it would be, I think, more a welcome relief from producers, knowing that both the animal owners as well as agricultural farms that are participating in the produce food safety program, that the data, their personal data and their business data will be kept confidential, and just as you would provide that type of protection for their business and decrease the vulnerability for unfair competition or other liabilities associated with releasing this data to the general public.
Follow-up, Senator Coghill.
So then the next question is, once that happens, you're probably going to have some kind of a bulletin alert that is not in place now. And I know we do that with other epidemiology. So what is the practice that you're going to have to institute in this arena? Or is it already something that you've instituted that that is already a process in play?
Senator Conkle, through the chair, we already have a communication plan for response to disease outbreaks. That's part of our, and we do have it as an emergency response plan for any disease outbreak, but one specifically for avian influenza, we have that that program set up, and this is very important for just our daily function of doing our job and providing or ensuring the animal health and safety of both wildlife and domestic animals in the state.
Follow up, Senator Coghill.
I haven't looked at the fiscal note, but I would anticipate that their usage is going to go up and that the bulletins would probably become a little more relevant. And am I understanding that correctly? And do you think that that's and I haven't seen a fiscal note. Is there a fiscal note that talks about this, or is that something that, that departmentally is going to be absorbed? It shows a zero fiscal
note. Senator Coghill, through the chair, there would be no fiscal note. There wouldn't be any increase in number of reports, only if there was an increase in outbreaks. We've maintained these communication reports as just part of our normal function. And so when we would have a disease outbreak, we normally would be releasing only the data that's appropriate or that's pertinent directly to that threat that's at hand. So a good example may be if we had a disease outbreak of tuberculosis on a farm, we would be contacting our other animal health participants, Fish and Game as well as USDA, about this outbreak. We would be contacting Department of Health and Social Services because tuberculosis from animals can be transmitted to people. And then we would be contacting the farms that are adjacent to that farm that had the outbreak to let those farmers know that there has been an outbreak and check to see if any of their animals may have had contact or been exposed. We then would go back and determine from the animal records where those animals originated from to determine where this disease may have been introduced, whether there was a new import of animals or the possibility that's happened in other states that there was a worker who came to the farm that actually had tuberculosis infected the animals. Then we would go ahead and look at those animal records, animal movement records, to see any animals that were moved from that farm to another farm, and then contact those individuals and test and do surveillance on their farms to see if that disease may have spread.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other questions? Yes, Senator Wilkowski.
Just trying to understand the term varietal. It just reads a little awkward to me. Page one, it talks about how certain records are not subject to disclosure, and then line 12, it says, if the records contain animal or crop test results or samples for disease or varietal. And then you look at the definition of varietal on the next page, line 12, and it says varietal means characteristic of or forming a distinct variety of organism. Just seems a little awkward to me or odd. Is that, have you guys read that? That jumped out to me and both my staff.
Senator Wilkowski for the chair. This is Christina Carpenter. I would have to defer that question to the Department of Natural Resources. I believe that that definition was added at their request. And I believe that Arthur Keyes is on the phone, so perhaps he can speak to it.
Yes, Mr. Keyes, could you talk a bit about the word varietal?
Yes, for the chair, Senator Wilkowski, could you repeat the question, please?
I guess I don't need an answer. I just would ask you to just take a second look at it, because for it's saying we're you can't disclose certain records that contain animal or crop test results or samples for a disease or varietal, and then you define varietal as a characteristic of or forming a distinct variety of an organism. It just reads awkward to me.
Certainly, for the chair, Senator Wilkowski, a variety, for example, potatoes, we have at the Plant Material Center, we have, I believe it's over 230 varieties of potatoes that we maintain in pre-nuclear material at the Plant Material Center. So variety is going to, a broad definition of different crops, different varieties of, like, for example, potatoes.
So, Mr. Keyes, this is Senator Giesel. What you're saying is this is a term of art for various varieties of particular vegetables or other plants. Is that what you're trying to say?
Senator Giesel, yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. For example, Red Delicious Apple, I think we all know what those are. I believe there's over 50 different varieties of Red Delicious Apple. And that holds true of potatoes, holds true of a lot of crops.
Did that help at all, Senator Wilkowski?
Yeah, I just wanted to bring it to your attention, and maybe if everybody else reads it, fine, then I guess I'm okay with it. It just does read a little awkward to me. I did have another question on another point, and that was on the question of page 2, lines 7 through 11, where it says, notwithstanding A of this section, DEC and DNR may disclose any records that are subject to this section if they find there is a threat to health or safety of an animal, crop, or the public. Just how does that work in reality? Is there like an appeal right? Because this is a Freedom of Information, this is Public Records Act, and is it one person decides whether this, and well, first of all, it's may, so there could be a legitimate threat to public safety, and I guess DNR and DEC could still choose not to disclose it. I guess, am I reading that correctly?
Yes, Senator Wilkowski, through the chair. This is Bob Gerlach, the state veterinarian. The information that would be released would be, that's correct, at the discretion of the Office of the State Veterinarian, but we would be in consultation with our director and commissioner in this process, so that we would not release all information. Say if we had an outbreak of a disease at a farm, we would release the information that was pertinent to the threat, either to other animals or to the public or to the issue of food safety, and not necessarily release the total number of animals that are on the farm, or that the farmer owned chickens, if it was a disease outbreak in cattle, that he owned other animals there, unless that disease would affect those other animals and that we would be concerned about those other species as being a source of spread of that. So the information that would be released would be directly to the immediate threat, and not just disclosing all the information that we've collected on that, about that farm or about that individual.
Follow-up, Senator Wilkowski?
I understand what you're saying. I guess I just want to point out to the committee and maybe anybody watching that we're essentially making DEC and DNR the complete gatekeeper of these records at this point if we pass this. And it's a policy call. Maybe that's what we want to do. Makes me a little bit uncomfortable that we're giving you so much power. We're not saying you shall disclose it. We're saying there could be this threat to safety of animals, crops, public, and you still cannot disclose it if you choose not to. So I just want people to understand what we're doing, and it's a policy call, I guess, at this point.
Senator Wilkowski, this is Dr. Gerlach. I'm bound by both my professional as well as my requirements from interaction with the USDA and other public health officials to go ahead and disclose that information. So if there is a threat, it must be disclosed. It can't be kept secret. And that's part of the information that is overseen by not just the one individual, whoever is state veterinarian at the time period, but whoever is in that position would be bound by those same professional ethics as well as bound by the duties to go ahead and discuss and report that to our other partners involved.
Yes, Senator Wilikowski.
I appreciate that. Could I get a copy of any statutes or regulations or ethical requirements that would bind somebody in DNR and DEC to disclose this information? That would be helpful for me. Thank you.
And Senator Wilikowski, Jennifer Curie from the Department of Law is online. I suspect she's the one that drafted the bill. Let me look. I can't tell right offhand. Ms. Curie, have you heard the line of questioning that's been going back and forth, and do you have any information that might be helpful?
Madam Chairwoman, this is Jennifer Curie from the Alaska Department of Law. I believe that Dr. Gerlach has addressed when he would be required to disclose. I imagine that there were circumstances that might require this information or some of this information to remain undisclosed, but I'm not 100% sure on that.
Ms. Curie, did you hear the concern about the term may disclose? And what I'm wondering is this particular section patterned after other confidential information and disclosure language? Why does it say may?
Madam Chairwoman, I did not draft this based on any other disclosure records or recommendations in statutes. But I can go back and take a look at those.
That would be helpful. I think it's a pertinent question that Senator Wilikowski's brought up. Any other questions from committee members? We also have ADF&G online, Bruce Dale, so a cadre of people to ask questions of. All right, seeing none, at this time I'd like to open public testimony on the bill. I don't see anyone online who wishes to testify. Is there anyone here in Juneau that wishes to testify? Oh, Amy is online. Gotcha. Thank you. Amy Seitz is online. Amy, did you wish to testify?
Yes, thank you, Chair Giesel and members of the Resource Committee. I would like to testify today on Senate Bill 164. And for the record, my name is Amy Seitz, Executive Director for the Alaska Farm Bureau. And I'm here to speak in support of Senate Bill 164, allowing confidentiality of certain personal and business records for our farmers will afford them some security in their business as well as help in keeping our ag sector healthy. In order to comply with state and federal laws, farmers have to provide certain information to DEC or DNR. There are also situations where a farmer may be required to submit test results or want to participate in voluntary disease testing. Records that DEC and DNR maintain can be very specific to particular animals or crops, information on our farmers' businesses, and results from testing. And under current law, these records are not protected. We want our farmers to feel comfortable working with state agencies in maintaining the health of our animals and crops, and also the public health. Knowing that someone can access specifics on these test results, who tested, where they're located, and what the test results were, does not afford farmers the securities necessary for them to participate in these testing for diseases. Having more farmers participating in testing could help us produce higher quality product and increase efficiencies in production. It could also help us in early detection of a possible outbreak of diseases, and our state agencies having this information could help them be ready in the event of a health concern. Our farmers should also have the security of knowing that certain import records are confidential and business records. Those records that identify a particular animal, crop, business, or individual shouldn't be public information, especially when we're looking at new rules like the produce safety rule coming online. If our farmers are going to be required to submit financial records to state agencies, they should be afforded the protections that those records are going to be confidential. There are other commercial industries that are already afforded those securities. And just some examples, recent examples. Right now, our farmers, some of our farmers are dealing with the sheep and goat issue where mycoplasma ovum pneumonia is of concern. And we opened up a voluntary testing program to find out what the prevalence is here in the state. Once the producers learned that there was not confidentiality within the Office of the State Vet, there was a lot of concern to participate. We did work around it, but it made it a little more of a hassle not being able to have that go through one office. Also, we've discussed the option of a disease-free certification program, like for people who want to do pack goating or goat packing. But again, once producers learned that there was not confidentiality of these records within the Office of the State Vet, there was a lot of reluctance to participate in something like that. So Senate Bill 164 would add a lot of protection for our farmers' businesses, but it would still allow, if there was a health or safety threat, that information could be released so the appropriate agencies could protect the public. And I guess with that, I would ask the Senate Resource Committee to support the passage of Senate Bill 164.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Seitz. I appreciated you bringing up the MOVI issue. It is a pretty sensitive issue, and it seems like you, as you've worked through that particular issue, you may have found a good middle ground if the information is kept confidential unless there is unless an issue arises. I wondered if you could explain perhaps better, more clearly, the term varietal. It's an odd term that those of us sitting here on the committee who are not farmers don't recognize. How would you define the word varietal?
I don't know that I'm the best, but I think Director Keyes did a good job of talking about what variety, the different varieties of potatoes, or even within carrots, there's several different varieties of carrots. I don't know that I'm the best one to explain varietal, but it is, I don't remember how many different varieties of potatoes Director Keyes mentioned that we have, but there's just, even within one crop, there's a lot of different sub-varieties.
So, Ms. Seitz, why would that have to be kept confidential?
Well, a lot of decisions on what to grow, that's a business decision for farmers. One farmer may discover they're really good at growing a specific variety of potato, and they may get it at where they buy it or where they get the seed start for it. They may not necessarily want a neighboring business to know. And I guess I'm a little more familiar with animal, but it can be associated with crops also. But from the animal side, if a farmer finds a really great breeder of a specific sheep breed down in the States, has the characteristics that they want for a market breed, and they get it's a good price, and they start importing those sheep up here. Right now, another farmer could find out where they are purchasing this breed and perhaps beat that farmer to that land crop for that year. So that's where knowing what specific variety or what specific animal breed, where they're getting them from. You know, that's a business decision for our farmers.
Great. Thank you. That actually does help, sort of some practical on the ground how it works. Any other questions for any of the folks online? I have no one else on the line wishing to testify. Is there anyone else in the room wishing to testify on this bill? Seeing no one, I'm going to leave public testimony open, and we'll set this bill aside. There was a legal question about the word may, so we'll look for getting information back about that before we hear the bill the next time. So with that, our meeting is concluded. Our next hearing will be Wednesday, and we have an interesting subject. It'll be the first hearing on Senate Bill 176. This is the tax credit bonding authorization proposal coming from the Department of Revenue, so that'll be of great interest. So we'll adjourn at this time. Let the record reflect. The time is 4:50 p.m.